Hello and welcome to episode 211 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And as usual, we are coming to you in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello!
Wow, hello!
It's been a long time since we've done a podcast now, because we did it Monday, and this week we're waiting until Wednesday to record, so it's solid 9 days here.
Wow.
A late happy belated birthday to you, good sir.
Oh, thanks, yeah. That's all I have to say.
I mean, it's not like I didn't actually wish you a happy birthday on your... You sounded like you were upset that I was doing it late.
Yeah, thanks for that.
You know what we celebrated with over the weekend?
What is that?
That's a little thing I like to call canties. Actually, canties.
That's what we should actually be excited for.
We sure are. So... I went down there to Georgetown Brewing on Saturday afternoon.
We're cracking these open right now. Yeah. I've been waiting to drink this for so long. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Obviously, it's this week's beer, because other than doing it as a growler, it's the first time that it can be this week's beer, which is awesome. So we mentioned this on last week's pod, that they were canning it for the first time because of the fact that, you know, it is not as readily available in bars as usual. And a terrific cause, all proceeds going to local restaurant and bar employees. Last week, we mentioned that it was 100% of total proceeds, and it turned out that I don't know what the word proceeds meant.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that meant profits, but it's all the revenue they're bringing in, and that's partially, as the box makes clear, because of their partners who made this possible through distribution and donations of ingredients and supplies. So shouts also to Columbia Distributing, Crown Distributing, Columbia Distributing. That's confusing, but two separate logos. Pioneer Beverage, Midway Beverage, Trip Distributing, Great Western Malt, Hollingberry and Son Hops, Hopsteiner, Roy Farms, and Westrock, whatever that is.
There we go. I mean, that's the most incredible thing about this. It's not just that we're drinking mayonnaise in the can. It's not just that it's a limited engagement. We're doing this for a good cause. It's like...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's also that we're drinking it so freshly after it was brewed.
It's like, incredible. I mean, you got this beer on Saturday at like 2 p.m., right? You got it
earlier than that, probably like one. And the box says,
oh my God,
it's got the time it's canned on here. Now I've lost where it is on it. 12:08 p.m.
That is incredible.
And they had so they rolled out at 10 a.m. and, you know, figured that there would be a bit of a line early. Gave it a couple hours to let things clear out and got there. It was a really great setup that Georgetown has going. Everyone's staying socially distanced. Basically, everyone who was there wearing masks. Most of it is outdoors, you know, because they've kind of got like an outdoor patio set up, although the bar itself is obviously under a roof. And they got people in and out very quickly. Just nothing but respect for the entire process.
It's incredible. I mean, I thought that they were, you know, the whole Georgetown machine for the last month was cranking out canties. But they're just like right there. They got the whole process set up and they're like, all right, we're open. We're fucking bottling these fuckers right now. And then you're getting them straight from the bottling into your hand to be drunk. It is incredible.
So if it's not realistic for you to get to Georgetown Brewing, they should be showing up in your as long as you've got Georgetown at your local grocery store.
Today?
Liquor store. They'd said today was the first day. Maybe a little longer depending on your location. But at some point in the near future, you definitely should be able to enjoy your own candies. It's a 6-week run of these. So, you know, it doesn't have to be a huge rush, but definitely look forward to drinking many of these over the next 6 weeks.
Well, and can I just say finally on this topic, and shouts, as always, to Georgetown Brewing Company, just an incredible situation that they set up here, but it tastes great. And that's really the best part of this, is just how good it tastes drinking a cool mayonnaise right now, especially on a nice Seattle late May day.
Correct. Now we're going to have to pour some out. Because we got the sad news last week. It was completely unsurprising that Seafair is officially canceling all its major events for 2020, including the Seafair Hydroplane Race, which had been held annually on Lake Washington since 1950. It is the first time in 71 years that there will not be unlimited hydroplane racing in Seattle during the summer.
Wow. RIP to Seafair, and also RIP to the Peltoncast. What are we going to do now? We have no content left over.
I think people honestly might have been organizing a wellness check on me when this news first came out. And look, nobody loves Seafair more than I do. But I also love people staying healthy and not being in large crowds right now. So it's obviously the right thing to do. It's interesting. They're the first location I've seen that is canceled any of this year's. I guess this year's hydroplane opener was also canceled. But Tri-Cities has not yet canceled their races. We may be over at the Columbia Cup. I don't consider it a likely.
I'm not going to the Columbia Cup. You will not find me at that Red Lion.
Well, yeah, I definitely July. Recommend the Red Lion.
Oh, man.
But seriously, I mean, Seafair is your summers. That's their slogan, right? Your Seattle summer. And I don't know how a summer will exist without it. But obviously, we're having to deal with a lot of, you know, things that are different from the norm right now. And these are minor inconveniences compared to the real legitimate problems created by this pandemic.
But it is kind of incredible the events that you consider like the milestones of summer and just not having any of them. Or it's like, and honestly, some of the events that I would personally in music consider milestones of the summer weren't probably going to happen anyway. Sasquatch, we know, wasn't going to happen and it's gone forever. Bumbershoot probably wasn't going to happen this year. I would say it almost certainly wasn't going to happen. And so it's like you have those two down. Capitol Block Party isn't happening in the middle of summer. And then with Seafair gone, it's like all of the pillars of summer are now gone. The Canis are really going to have to carry a lot of weight here.
Going to have to sustain us. They may have to extend this beyond 6 weeks. 6 weeks might be optimistic. We'll see what – I mean, phase two, we may have some restaurants open at limited capacity well before that, but we'll see. In happier news, one event that is going on remotely on June 21st is this year's ESPY Awards, and it's going to be a heavy Seattle theme here.
Crazy.
The three co-hosts announced on Tuesday, Sue Bird, Megan Rapinoe, your number one Seattle power couple, and then maybe half of your number two Seattle power couple, Russell Wilson, with Sierra also expected to perform. So there you go.
Sure, of course. It's pretty incredible when I saw this, that it was an all-Seattle host for the ESPYs.
And it makes sense. I mean, they're three of our biggest stars, people who have, you know, shown the ability to pull off events like this.
Does it make sense?
I mean, none of them...
It didn't seem a little strange to you?
None of them individually doesn't make sense, let's put it that way.
Sure, okay. It's like, we don't get a basketball team, but all three hosts of the ESPYs is definitely something.
I gotta admit, I dreaded for the Sonics to be back. Sorry, Sue, Megan, and Russ.
And then, as always, we should toast to the frontline workers who are out there keeping everybody safe during this quarantine.
Absolutely. Did you have a question for me?
Two questions for you. Number one, this is not the question that I had. First and foremost, since I don't think we're going to be talking about this later on, for people who might not have seen the exact updates or needed some clarification, can you explain to us what is happening with the NBA? What's the chatter, at least, as of right now?
So we got the announcement from the league last weekend that they are in negotiations with Disney to host the return to play at Disney World exclusively, not two sites, just at Disney World. They mentioned late July resumption of play. Subsequent reporting has said possibly August. And the question that, you know, seems to be the focus of deliberations right now is how many teams are going to be there? What will the format be? And you know, the reporting today has seemed to indicate that the momentum is toward, I believe, 20 teams. So okay. It would be the 16 playoff teams when the season was halted, and then also the four teams that were in playoff contention in the Western Conference, which would include the Blazers.
Interesting. So those four extra teams, does that look like a play-in tournament, or are they just playing games to try to get to the playoffs?
Unclear. Could be. There's also been a lot of discussion this week. Several people have reported the possibility of a group stage rather than the first round of the playoffs.
Really?
Yeah, so you do it more like the World Cup, where you separate into five groups of four or something like that.
And the top groups of five, three teams advance or something?
Four groups of five, and the top two from each group advance.
And then so you go straight to an Elite Eight.
Yes.
That's pretty interesting. How would those groupings be made?
You'd probably draw from pots similar to the World Cup based on your record, you know, top four teams. So you assure that they're not going to, or the top five teams, whatever, I guess, top four teams, you assure that none of them are going to be in the same group with each other in the next four and so on and so forth.
And then how many times do you play each other? Like two games against each team?
Presumably.
This is pretty interesting, right?
I mean, there's a lot of interesting possibilities. There's also been discussion of, you know, if that isn't the format, of the possibility of seeding 1 to 16. Seems that that's somewhat unlikely to happen because of the, you know, East teams objecting to that. But that's, you know, normally the issues that are making that difficult in terms of travel and the time zones, scheduling of games, things like that. Well, those are all out the window now if everybody's in the same spot. So it's a chance to try it for sure.
Interesting. Well, so I think we talked about this before, but Nurk was ready to come back for the Blazers, and all indications are that if they are there in Orlando with the chance to compete in some sort of playoffs or opportunity to get to the playoffs, Nurk will be playing. Do you feel like the Blazers, despite the fact that they had a down season, could have a chance in a group stage?
I mean, if it's only two teams advancing, that's going to be tough, but obviously it's better than the chances they would have had if the season played out normally, because, you know, then you would have done no better than be the seventh or eighth, you know, you would have done no better than the eighth seed anyway. Damian Lillard, let's see, he told Jalen and Jacoby, apparently, that he's 100% positive that Collins and Nurkic would be available if
wow.
the Blazers play. Yeah.
There we go. And then is New Orleans also included in that group of 20? Is Zion going to be there?
Yes. They're the ninth seed, you know, tied for ninth in the West, so they would definitely be part of it.
And the Blazers are 10th?
I believe they're also tied for ninth.
Wow. Man, that works out perfectly for the NBA.
It does, yeah. It's a pretty natural, you know, break, I would say, where those four teams, Portland, New Orleans, Sacramento, and San Antonio, were the ones legitimately with a playoff shot.
Well, they get Portland, New Orleans, and then have to take Sacramento and San Antonio. okay, well, that's interesting. I'm excited to keep monitoring that situation. It would just be nice to have something to pay attention to. I'd feel like late July, it's really not that long from now. It feels like an eternity until late July. But it would just be nice to have something new in sports to pay attention to.
Well,
we are going to be doing
things.
Oh, there we go. My question for you, though, is I had seen of one of these internet – the things that were going around on Twitter, questions that you're supposed to answer, right? Your pick twos and things like that. But it was a question of if you could change one play in the history of sports, which one would it be? So my question for you is there a single play that you think you could pinpoint – that would have made the Sonics more likely to have stayed in Seattle?
No. I mean, I you know, like there's people who say, oh, if they'd won the 96 championship, they would have stayed. I don't believe that. I don't think it ultimately would have made that big of a difference. I mean, you're asking me if I would change one play in Sonics history?
Or is there anything that could have played out differently aside from stuff at – is there anything on the court that could have played out differently to have changed? Like, obviously you could say like they approved an arena, but that's not interesting. But like on the court that could have happened differently or whatever, breaks the game that could have changed the course of the franchise being in Seattle.
I mean, maybe if things go differently in 94 and 95, then, you know, the Sonics are even more dominant in terms of local interest. I don't know, though. I mean, you know, they couldn't have had that much more interest than they did coming off the 96 finals. And again, that didn't matter. So I don't think so. I mean, the answer for which play we'd change is obvious, right?
As sports fans in Seattle, yes, of course. But, like, okay. I'm talking specifically for the Sonics.
I mean, actually, the worst thing that happened to us probably is?
What?
The answer is probably you take away the double. I mean, if we want to be real honest here, that's
how this is what I was looking for. This is the kind of content that I was asking for.
We ruin our childhoods to save our adulthoods.
Wow. Oh my god. The Mariners don't score in the bottom of the 11th.
Real crushing blow to 13 and 10 year old Kevin Entrista.
Joey Cora is just crying there in game 5. I mean, we know that that's the most iconic play in Mariners history or whatever. Like, it's commemorated outside. But, like, and we've talked about this before, it was a division round victory. Like, obviously, we'd trade 100 times out of 100 to bring a franchise back. But, like, they just lost the next round.
Well, I mean, the point is, it probably did save the Mariners. It's just that we would rather have the Sonics than the Mariners, if that was the trade-off.
Or do you take it even farther back? I love the double as a singular play, because it's the most iconic play in Mariners history.
We're just writing it out.
Or do you just take it even further back and have them lose the one-game playoff to the Angels?
Yeah, I mean, there's not necessarily the one-play aspect, because they were already losing all the time. Luis Soho, they're all going to score.
Man, I love that as the one play that would have saved the Sonics. So you don't think – let's say that they – that's the difference, though, is that, like, if they win the championship in either of the two non-Jordan years, like, are things actually that different?
Probably not. But also, I mean, they weren't one play away from winning either of those championships. I guess maybe in 94 they went to overtime. So if you change one play at the end of regulation, possibly.
That was the one that I thought of, was the Mutombo. Like, I don't know if there was – I don't know any single play that happened in that Game 5 loss to the Nuggets. But, like, it still seems pretty likely that if they beat the Nuggets, they probably would have gone to the finals.
I mean, they would have beat Houston if they would have played them, because they just owned the Rockets in that era.
Uh-huh.
I don't know for sure. They probably would have beaten Utah in 94. So, yeah, I think they probably would have gone to the finals.
Like, they would have been – would they have been favored in every single series that they played in?
Yeah, I mean, they were the best team in the league.
So, if there's one play – this is nowhere near as fun as taking away the double. if there was one other play that could have hypothetically made a difference, I feel like – if they win a championship in 94, it definitely changes things.
Yeah. But I don't know if it changes things or not.
You think David Stern would have... I mean, a team that would have won a championship almost, like, within just a little bit over a decade, that he would have had that team move?
If they refused to build a new arena. Yeah, I think so.
Well... we'll take away the double.
It was a good run, double.
And so also in current sports, what's happening right now?
Yeah, it's basically our update on where leagues stand. I wanted to start with the NHL, which is planning to move forward with a 24-team playoff and still plans – they've canceled the remainder of their regular season. Still plans an 82-game season in 2020-21, according to Commissioner Gary Bettman, who said it could start as late as January 2021. And I think this is interesting because presumably this pushes back the 2021-22 season and the debut of the NHL Seattle team. And I think that's – I mean, it's obviously disappointing for NHL Seattle fans, you know, assuming that by that point – there's either a vaccine or the virus is under control enough that you would be able to have fans in the stands for a 2021-22 season. But it's kind of good news for NHL Seattle in terms of pushing the timeline back means less pressure on the arena construction process.
Interesting. So you don't think there's any chance that they could push to try to be part of the 2020-21 season?
No, that wouldn't be realistic.
There'd be no way that they could have the arena. Does it matter if there's an arena done?
I guess that's true, but still, I think the timeline of when you're planning expansion drafts and everything like that, I don't think you can just spring on teams, hey, there's an expansion draft in a month.
I mean, I don't really see why not. They just sprung on them that this, like, they're just like, we're going to the playoffs. Is it that different?
Yeah, I think that's different.
I mean, if you look at it, like, let's assume that let's just call it the 2021 season if they're going to start in January. That happens in January. Like, if there are no fans in the arena, they could play it wherever, right? Like, the yes. Seattle team could play in Tacoma or they could play in Everett. And then if the assumption is like they would try to potentially vaccine or whatever happens.
Yeah, I'm only thinking that in terms of if there's a one site, because if it's not that, then I don't know if the NHLPA is going to be okay playing in Tacoma or Everett. I guess.
Why? What's the difference?
I guess
if there are no fans, who cares?
But it's the quality of the facilities is not up to NHL standards. Now, you could hypothetically play in Portland.
Yeah, it literally does not matter.
But
I mean, that's the thing about these games happening without without fans. It really reduces everybody down to what we are with NBA in Seattle. It's like, you know, yes, you can get sort of like caught up in your hometown team, but that element of like being able to go and see these games happen in person is like when you break it down to like, why do I care where these teams play? You know what I mean? Like the basic element of like, what do I care about sports for? And it's like, I can go and see these athletes playing in my hometown, right?
That's the only element of it. I mean, there's also the element of like all the games are on TV locally. It's what's discussed in the local newspaper or in the local TV stations. I think there's a little more to it than just the act of physically attending games. There's a lot of people who live in local markets. This is something Adam Silver has been fond of pointing out during this whole process. Most NBA fans do not attend NBA games.
It's just the possibility that you could.
I suppose.
I mean, for me personally, most of the sports that I pay attention to, I see either every game or a lot of the games in person. Or I will go at least a few times per year and see them in person.
Yes. Anyways, I don't think that the NHL Seattle team will play in the 2020-21 season, no matter when it.
What does that do? Well, you were saying that it might push back then what we're calling the 2021-2022 season.
I mean, like, probably the most interesting aspect of this is if we're at a point as a society where you can hold a draft with fans attending, it was going to be dicey, I think, for the arena to be complete in time for the 2021 draft. But if the 2021 draft is in August instead of June, then it's way more realistic.
Sure. But like, when do you get quote unquote back on track? Like, are these just the new season timelines for the NBA and the NHL now? Is this it?
I think you'd probably just shave a week or two off the off season and gradually try to get back. I mean, maybe in the NBA, it's more possible that you could start in December and just have that be the season. I don't think the NHL is interested in that.
Really?
There's not the same degree of overlap between NHL fans and football fans as there is NBA fans and football fans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
think about Summer League. If Summer League's in the middle of the NFL season in the NBA,
it is an interesting possibility.
It'd be pretty weird. I mean, I think it would probably be terrible because, like, it would just be so packed, especially now that there's going to be an NFL team in Vegas. But, like, if you're there in, let's say it's September that Summer League is happening in Vegas, it might even kill the Vegas Summer League and they'll just be in Utah or whatever.
I doubt that would happen. But it's not as desirable to do it because, I mean, part of the reason Vegas wants it there is it comes during a downtime for them.
Yes. But yeah, I mean, the NBA could run very realistically and easily. I mean, Simmons has talked about this a lot. December, Christmas Day, or somewhere about there through mid-August.
All right, I want to note that we have a lot of 2011 to remember, so maybe we should move through this a bit more quickly.
Okay. This is interesting stuff, though. I'm fascinated about how it looks. And if you were to draw up a sports calendar, I think that's more what you would draw it to look like.
Not me personally. I like the NBA schedule the way it is now. But
what maximizes your time off?
It doesn't matter. Yes, it does. Yes.
Well, you get time off over the summer.
Which is nice. So MLB and its players, contentious negotiations right now over the restart of their season. But one piece of good news, Ryan Divish reported on Wednesday night that Mariners GM Jerry Dipoto sent a letter to minor leaguers in the Mariners organization telling them they will be paid through the remainder of the 2020 season, even though it seems unlikely that even if there is a major league return to play that we will see any minor league action this year.
Mm-hmm. So, and the Mariners play in Oklahoma now that the double didn't happen, right?
Wow. Tampa Bay, right?
They're in Tampa. Yeah.
Who knows where that expansion team went? Maybe to Portland. The A's had announced earlier this week that they will only be paying their players through the end of the month, their minor league players. So this God is damn. Contrasting the Mariners with the A's in a positive light. So the first league that has announced definitive plans to come back, and the earliest plans that we are likely to see, I think, the NWSL, which will return with the Challenge Cup competition in Sandy, Utah, hosted by Utah Royals FC, with a four-game group stage followed by an eight-team tournament kicking off June 27th with the final to be played July 26th. So we would be a month away from soccer in the U.S. if this goes as planned.
There we go.
The Reign will resume training tomorrow in Thurston County, which is currently in Phase 2 of Washington's phased reopening plan, before heading to Utah to continue their preparations for this tournament.
And who owns the TV rights for the NWSL?
CBS was CBS, just announced as a partner.
These games are going to be highly – I'm excited to watch this, and I've never watched an NWSL match on TV before, I don't think.
I've watched a few of them. I watched when they were on Lifetime a few years ago. But, yeah, I think that it's definitely – that's why they're probably so eager to – you know, get going, is they can capture this market that clearly is starved for team sports. One of the remaining question marks is who exactly is going to participate. There's some talk that members of the U.S. women's national team may be reluctant to participate, given some concerns about, you know, the safety of this plan and all that. Have not heard anything yet on whether Megan Rapinoe will be part of the Reign for this.
Okay.
Which is all voluntary. Haven't heard yet what the plan is in the WNBA, but the WNBA plans to send its first round of paychecks to players on June 1st, and as part of that, teams were forced to cut down to their regular season roster of 12 before any kind of training camp or anything like that. The Storm waived this year's second and third round picks Joyner Holmes and Haley Gorecki to complete their roster, which means is expected 2019 first round pick Ezzy Megbegor will be part of the roster if there is a 2020 season. UW men's basketball news. On the transfer front again, Michigan wing Cole Bajima is transferring to UW. The Linden native spent one season in Ann Arbor playing sparingly as a true freshman, a four-star recruit. He's noted for his shooting ability and gives the Huskies 12 scholarships committed for the 2020-21 season. An important question here with a pair of transfers, Bajima and earlier Eric Stevenson from Michigan
State. I was
going to
say, didn't they already sign this guy like 2 months ago?
No, these are different players. Bajima's bigger. He's not quite as athletic as Eric Stevenson. Gary Bedore of the Kansas City Star reported that the transfer rule in the NCAA for men's basketball and football won't change for 2021. It is possible that one-time transfers without redshirt, the option for all players to transfer one time without a redshirt, will be approved for the 21-22 season. It's very confusing to say the 2021-22 season, by the way.
Yeah, I hate that. Yeah.
It's a real problem. Case-by-case exceptions will remain the norm for the upcoming season. It'll be interesting to see how much leeway there is with players returning home, given the effects of the pandemic, will be the case for both of the players transferring to UW.
Well, this confirms what we had already guessed, which is that even a global pandemic will not force the NCAA to change their antiquated fucking rules.
I mean, this one there's less universal support for than, you know, the name and likeness issue. I think it's probably somewhat less pressing, but certainly I think something that would be a positive. I don't think that, you know, transferring should be seen as a negative or, you know, any kind of detriment for a player. Like, sometimes you go somewhere and find out it's not a fit. Like, that's the nature of, you know, college for all of us. Mrs. Fantasy Genius was a transfer.
Wow. Really makes you think, doesn't it?
And look at how well that worked out. She ended up meeting you.
She's anti-transfer rules.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Should have stayed. So I think the encouraging thing here is UW adding another shooter is, you know, whether Badgham is able to play next year, how much he plays next year, long-term shooting.
Whether anybody is able to play next year.
That too. That's that important point.
I mean, college sports are going to be the whole climate. Like, we're going to talk about Husky football in a second. If we're putting odds on these things happening, I would say that college football is the least likely of any of these sports we're discussing to happen.
I mean, it's interesting because there's so much money at stake for these athletic departments. I would say of the sports we're discussing, the WNBA is probably the least likely to play.
Okay.
Although I think they will probably figure out something similar to what we've seen with the NWSL and also.
It doesn't take that much. How many teams are there?
12.
There's 12 teams of like 12 players.
True.
Like.
And
you can do that so much easier than hundreds of teams spread throughout the country with like almost 100 players on each team. And colleges, they're going to be colleges that are not going to be open.
Yeah, the campuses will not be open. By the way, my money is on since the NBA is headed to Orlando, my money is on the WNBA will be the one that ends up in Vegas.
Interesting.
Which would actually work out kind of, it would be kind of cool because presumably the NBA games in Vegas would be ending by like 7 p.m. Pacific. And then you'd be able to play like the nightcap would be the WNBA games. So that would
the NBA cool. games are going to end at 7 Pacific? Jesus Christ.
Well, they're all being played in Orlando. I don't think they're going to go that long. I mean, maybe it's 11, you know, but it's 8 p.m. Eastern or Pacific. But
okay.
You know you're not.
All right. I'll take it for basketball. Not having super late playoff basketball is kind of a bummer, but I'll accept it.
All right. On the UW football front, got a commitment last weekend from tight end Quentin Moore, who is from Kenmore and went to Englemore before heading to Independence Community College in Kansas. Is a non-qualifier. He is heading into his sophomore season at Independence and will be part of the 2021 recruiting class for the Huskies with either two or three seasons of eligibility, depending whether he plays this year. Moore's father, Mark Moore, played for the Seahawks in 1987, is a safety.
There we go. Yeah. Setting up that Independence Community College in Kansas pipeline.
I think it's more the local tie probably than the Independence tie.
Nope.
Speaking of, I mean, look, they once upon a time had a pipeline to. What was the name of the school in Florida where John Anderson and who was the really super fast receiver?
Charles Frederick.
Yeah, they both went to the same high school, but I forget what the name.
I can't remember what that school was. Yeah, they got a kicker and a wide receiver.
But it was so random to have back-to-back guys from Florida. Not a frequent fertile recruiting ground for Pope John Paul II.
Oh, there we go.
In where is this? Boca Raton.
Oh.
Boca Raton. So speaking of the Seahawks, they made a move last week. After a rumored offer to Devontae Freeman, they ended up signing veteran running back Carlos Hyde on Friday to a one-year deal reportedly worth up to $4 million. Hyde will turn 30 in September. It's the sixth team in the last four seasons. After he spent his first four seasons with the 49ers, who drafted him in the second round last year at the end of training camp, he was traded by the Chiefs, with whom he'd signed last spring, to the Texans and started 14 games in Houston for the injured Lamar Miller, averaging 4.4 yards per carry after two seasons below 4.0. not really a receiving threat, just 75 receiving yards the past two seasons combined. And if you look at Football Outsiders DR, pretty much gave back all the value he had as a runner last year with his pass catching. But probably not surprising, his career versus the Seahawks, 5.2 yards per carry, including a couple of really big performances. I thought this was funny. The 49ers went 0-6 in games Carlos Hyde played against the Seahawks.
Wow. Despite him playing well. Oh, my God. It's so perfect. And what Pete Carroll took from those games was that Carlos Hyde played well, not that the Seahawks won the game.
In a vacuum, I don't hate this move. Yeah. But the fact that you're paying that much money to a running back when Jadeveon Clowney remains unsigned is just... It's very Seahawks-y.
What do you mean in a vacuum? Like, you think even if Jadeveon Clowney is not a possibility, you think this is a good signing?
No, but I don't think it's the worst signing of the offseason in that.
I guess if that's your barometer. What's the worst signing of the offseason?
Oh, it's Cedric Ogbe.
Carlos Hyde's going to be cut by the Seahawks at the end of training camp. Like, there's, I don't know what
last until if, you know, first off, again, this is assuming there is a season. It seems another indication that Rashad Penny will probably start the year on the PUP list.
Boy, he at the very least probably will be on the roster throughout the season. Like,
yeah, but he might be on the roster ahead of better players.
What is the difference between? First off, first question for you. If I would have asked you how old Carlos Hyde was, what would you have said?
I think that's about what I would have guessed.
That he was like 36 years old. I swear to God, Carlos Hyde has been around forever.
I think you're thinking of Frank Gore. That was a different 49ers running back.
Probably will outlast Carlos Hyde also. This does not make sense in a vacuum. You're just totally wrong. Would you rather have... random, either of the Miami players that they drafted in the last 2 years, random just running back off the street, or Carlos Hyde at $4 million?
Probably one of the Miami running backs.
So then how does this make sense in a vacuum? You can find a running back who, like, what do you think the chances are that Carlos Hyde will be a better running back on the field than either of the Miami running backs? Or, like I said, a literal random running back off the street.
I don't know, maybe one in three? I don't know, one in something like that? I don't know.
Or how much better, like, what do you even think the window of possibility for them being that enough better to reach that salary is? Like, you'd have to be, like, a significantly better than an off-the-street running back to be worth that salary.
Yeah. I mean, running backs don't matter. Like...
But that's what I'm saying. That's why this doesn't make sense in a vacuum. If your definition of in a vacuum is for the Seahawks, this isn't the worst move they've made all offseason, then sure. But in a vacuum is not what that means. That means that you're saying, irrelevant of Jadeveon Clowney, this move makes no sense at all in any regard.
I mean, it's the Seahawks. What do you expect?
So you're saying this is a Seahawks move. You're not surprised by it. Sure. Of course I'm not surprised by it. That doesn't make it good.
I mean, supposedly they offered the same deal to Devontae Freeman and he turned him down. I do think Carlos Hyde is probably a better running back at this stage of his career than Devontae Freeman.
I mean, I have no evidence or basis for this, but my gut feeling is that Devontae Freeman is a better running back. I feel like Devontae Freeman probably is involved in the passing game better. He just seems like a better running back, but he has to be younger, right? At least 3 years younger.
He dropped off pretty substantially. He's 28. He's 2 years younger. He dropped off pretty substantially last year, 3.6 yards per carry. I mean, I know yards per carry is not that good a metric, but I mean, he was productive as a receiver.
Devontae Freeman.
But that he had a lot of catches, I should say. Let me not go so far as to say he was.
It's Sark's offense.
He was productive as a receiver. That's a different thing altogether.
He is probably a more productive receiver than Carlos Hyde. I love the idea that Devontae Freeman got offered a deal worth up to $4 million and was like, nah, I'm good. Like, where are you going to find more money than that, Devontae Freeman?
Yeah, I guess combined rushing plus receiving value, he was better last year.
There we go! There it is! Oh, man. It doesn't matter. None of this matters. Whomever this running back is that they sign is definitely not going to finish the season on the team, is not going to be the primary back. They paid up to $4 million for somebody to be your second running back when I assume that there's a better running back between DJ Dallas or what's-his-name on this roster.
Wow, the disrespect to Travis Homer.
Homer. They all could have great names, too. Travis Homer and DJ Dallas.
They could have just brought back Marshawn.
That's what I'm saying, though. Bring back Marshawn at the minimum. He wanted to be here. Like, do you actually think that Marshawn at the minimum will be a worse value than Carlos Hyde?
No.
Sorry. No fucking way! Plus, every time he scores a touchdown, it'll be the best moment of the year.
Well, it won't be, because it would have been, is what you meant.
Well, yeah, I have no feelings about Carlos Hyde. Wait, and maybe that's actually a positive, because then, like, fans won't be cheering on the Seahawks to putting Carlos Hyde at the goal line. But, like, come on.
He had some solid moments for my fantasy team last year.
Carlos Hyde? And you're losing fantasy team? Wow. If Carlos Hyde was on your fantasy team, he didn't have that many. Your whole team in general didn't have that many solid moments. Whew. This is a terrible move.
The regular season in like two of the three leagues I was in.
Carlos Hyde carried you there.
I should not say that.
Oh my god. Devontae Freeman would have been better in a PPR league. Anyway, it's fine. Whatever. Who cares? Okay, so here's a question for you, which I was thinking about, because I read somebody say that potentially, this was just a complete supposition or whatever. Potentially, let's say that this next NFL season, the cap is set, right, for the 2020 season.
Yeah.
If there's a season with no ticket revenue, the salary cap will plummet the year after that, right?
I mean, presumably there would be some kind of smoothing that the league and players would agree to, but yeah, revenue would plummet, yes.
Is this a logic? Is this some... Because the Seahawks have signed basically everybody to one-year deals that they've signed, right?
Yeah, but they did that shit pre-pandemic, too.
Does this make that strategy, which is maybe a terrible strategy, a slightly better strategy because salaries are just going to be lower in 2021. So let's say that you sign, you know, you'd rather have whatever free agent, the 2021 version of a boy year, whatever, for the lower number than you would 2 years of somebody else. And maybe that's part of the fear with Clowney of locking him up to a long-term deal.
I mean, maybe, but most of free agency was conducted, I mean, all of free agency was conducted post-pandemic, you know, other than, like, some of the guys who got released and signed before it, so I don't think that's a big factor.
Okay.
This is just what they do.
Great. Well, the chart was going around with how the Seahawks spent their money this offseason, and it is just shocking to see.
You gotta attribute that to its source.
To Ben?
The Belton brother, Ben Baldwin.
It is a sight to see how the Seahawks spent their money this offseason. To me, the worst signing, I think, is the Jaron Reed signing. Not that I don't love, or really the Bruce Irvin number. That cap number was massive. I assume that Bruce Irvin would be closer to like Benson Mayoa money. But Jaron Reed getting $10 million plus per year, when I'm pretty skeptical of the market that was out there for him, that's the one where you're just like, God, they paid him a lot of money.
I'm going to go with David Moore at $2.1 million. I know that's not a big number, but David Moore probably doesn't belong on the Seahawks, period.
Uh-huh.
And he's making more than the minimum.
It's really pick your poison of worst.
Because it's like, worst contract, if they play Carlos Hyde... Yeah, he's probably the same as those other guys. But David Moore is actively bad at football.
Mm-hmm.
So Yeah, that one's pretty high on my list. Also, Jacob Hollister at $3.3 million.
Oh God. Well, especially when you also sign Greg Olsen. Like, they're paying Hollister $3.3 million. Jesus Christ.
I don't know if he's going to make the roster. We'll see where Will Disley is.
They're going to have to release him. Like, you just... There's too much money going around. They spent a lot of money on extremely average players.
A lot of money on extremely average players. Your 2020 Seattle Seahawks. A couple of guys who could be Seahawks, plausibly. Let's talk about some wide receivers, because they haven't done a whole lot there thus far. Just signing Philip Dorsett is a free agent. Pro Football Talk reported that Josh Gordon will apply for reinstatement soon. He posted a tweet of working out in Seattle, although, you know, obviously not with the Seahawks, because no one is working out at Seahawks facilities. Though the new CBA no longer features suspensions for marijuana tests, reinstatement is not automatic. But last Wednesday, Alden Smith, the troubled former San Francisco 49er, now I guess I think he's a free agent. He was most recently with the Cowboys, but I think he's a free agent. So possible hope there for Gordon, who would be an unrestricted free agent if he's reinstated.
Great. Sign me up.
I certainly feel a lot better than that when the other name that has come up, which is that John Clayton of ESPN Seattle, reported that Russell Wilson, quote, would love to add Antonio Brown.
Great. Like, that's not even a report. That's such a non-report. Like, sure. Like, Russell Wilson would love to add a wide receiver of the caliber of Antonio Brown.
No, I think he'd specifically love to add Antonio Brown.
But it's just like, Antonio Brown is the wide receiver of Antonio Brown's caliber that is out there. But like, this is not factoring in any of the baggage that goes along with signing Antonio Brown. I think there are a lot of quarterbacks who would love to add Antonio Brown.
I would not love to add Antonio Brown.
Yeah, but I'm saying there are a lot of quarterbacks who would love to add Antonio Brown.
I just want that on the record.
Okay. That doesn't surprise me that Russell Wilson would love to add Antonio Brown. But is that going to happen? No. It's a non-story.
I was going to say we should talk about a happier time for the Seahawks. I'm not 100% sure that's true, though. Because it's time to remember some years presented by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza and turn it back to 2001. 2011.
Because Pagliacci is cold-blooded, and so is 2011.
Oh, that's definitely the highlight of the year. A fascinating year for the Huskies, who back in 2010 missed out on five-star prospect Terrence Jones after he initially committed to UW and later changed his mind and ended up at Kentucky.
God, we should have Katie on to talk about her thoughts about that.
Still added a recruiting class headlined by Terrence Ross, his teammate at Jefferson High School in Portland. The Huskies played in Maui Invitational for the first and only time in program history, crushing an early Tony Bennett Virginia team 106-63 in their opener, setting up a matchup in the semifinal against Terrence Jones and number 8 Kentucky, losing 74-67, and then losing 76-71 to number 2 Michigan State in the consolation game.
We held our own in both of those. I remember it snowed. This was Thanksgiving week, which I guess Maui Invitational always is.
By definition, yes.
But it snowed in Seattle that week, and that's right, so we were stuck in watching those. I remember it being really dark, but just destroying Virginia, which was very fun, coming off having Tony Bennett in the Pac-12. 10.
Yeah, and it was specifically. The Huskies finished non-conference play 8-3 with 3 losses, coming by a combined 13 points. They then started Pac-10 play 7-1, but slumped, finishing 11-7. And came into the Pac-10 tournament on the bubble before they beat Wazoo 89-87 in the opener despite 43 points from Clay Thompson. Still remember watching that game at the famous Cousin Katie's house. And then blew out Oregon in the semifinal, a game that I do not remember at all.
That's
Lost history.
Yeah, I don't know what part of the sandwich it is, but it's the bad part. It's the most forgettable part of the sandwich.
It's a really bad part of the sandwich. The bread is more memorable than the filling.
Really, I suppose this the sandwich that they made in this tournament is a very good bread sandwich.
And then used Thomas's game winner to beat number 16 Arizona 77-75 in overtime for their second consecutive Pac-10 tournament championship, of course immortalized on CBS by Gus Johnson.
God, nobody else could have called that shot. This was, I think, the most fun 3 days in a row in Washington Husky history basketball. Like, just one after another. Like, that game against Klay Thompson, like, I mean, do I remember any of the beats from it? Not really. But, like, when I think about the game and the things that I feel were, like, this, we were watching an incredible basketball game. And, like, seeing what Klay Thompson did going against Isaiah Thomas and that, it was just, like, this is fun to watch. Like, we wanted the Huskies to win, but, like, the situation is amazing. And it was, like, I don't know if we really fully anticipated how good of an NBA player Klay Thompson would be, but it was
100% did not. I was very skeptical of Klay.
He was a freaking monster in that game.
Mostly because of the game his sophomore year where he was like pouting on the court at UW. That was a rough go for him.
I remember Klay seeming like quite the baby in college, which now I think he has the reputation of being pretty tough after like tearing his Achilles and shooting free throws. But that one, where it was just like, I think that was like the later game, and it was just like, we went to Katie's for
last
it.
Last game of the night, yeah.
And we went there, I think it was us, Katie and Ben, and Chris Smith was there. I'm pretty sure Chris was with us each night. And then it was just like, control C, control V, each day in a row, of just like, that's the best thing about, you know, the NCAA tournament is extremely fun. Conference tournaments, when your team is good, are pretty fun. Because you're just, like, constantly watching your team play. Like, there's no other situation where you get to watch the Huskies play 3 days in a row like that. But if they're winning, well, you're just, like, back for more.
Another situation is the preseason tournament. So well, we had both of those.
I suppose it was the same in the Maui Invitational, but there was a lot of disappointment in the Maui Invitational. there was a lot of being so close. But all of that, and there's just, like, we're back for more. It's like you wake up, it's like rinse, repeat. You're right there, and you're watching them play and beating Oregon. Like, you beat Wazoo, Oregon, and then Arizona en route to the Pac-10 champion. This is Pac-10 at the time, right?
Yes.
En route to the Pac-10 championship. Like, you could not choose a better group of three teams to beat on the way to winning the Pac-10.
You'll know it's the Pac-12 when we start losing to Colorado and Utah every year in the tournament.
But right, there's no like Arizona State game in there. There's no Oregon State. Like, this is who you want to play.
Stanford might be on that mix for me.
Stanford? But... we're talking about Stanford. I love that UCLA wasn't the team. But it's
no,
like
definitely not.
Arizona has been the long-term foil in the Pac-10. They've been probably the best team in the Pac-10 since we've been paying attention to college basketball. Then you have your two biggest rivals right there. Like, that is who you want. Not Stanford. Come on.
I consider Stanford a pretty big rival. Maybe more than Oregon college basketball.
No way.
So this was also I feel like, has UW ever played UCLA in the Pac-10 tournament? I mean, obviously they have, but I don't remember.
Yeah, they definitely have. I don't remember it, but they definitely have.
They played one of the they played them in like 2004, I think, maybe. Anyways, this is also a big coming out tournament for Terrence Ross, who had not started a game prior to the Pac-10 tournament. Started all three of those games, averaged 15.3 points per game, and really gave the first glimpse of the NBA, you know, quality NBA player that he was going to become. Okay, so the Huskies get the number 7 seed in the East region. They faced number 10 Georgia in the opening round, beating them 68-65 on Friday night in Charlotte before a 9 a.m. Pacific start on Sunday versus number 2 North Carolina.
In North Carolina, right?
In Charlotte, yes.
Oh, yeah, in Charlotte. Just so, like...
this is where you just rue the fact that the Huskies had all these close losses particularly the ones in Maui. Because, like, they win a couple more of those. They're a 5 seed.
Oh, they, you know, they were a better totally team different. Than a 7 seed. I mean, they lost to Michigan State by 2. I remember watching that Kentucky game, and there were definitely points where I was like, we're going to win this.
Oh, for sure. I mean, they finished the season ranked 16th in KenPom and 334th in the luck rating.
Really?
So, I mean, this was right up there with the best of the Romar teams statistically, and they went 24-11. That's so frustrating. So they played to North Carolina tough, end up losing 86-83 with a controversial call in the closing seconds when referees refused to review the amount of time on the clock for the possible tying play, one that was basically admitted, everyone said, was an error immediately afterwards.
And maybe playing this game in Charlotte might have had something to do with that.
I don't know if I would say that specifically.
Come on. This was basically the worst possible setup you could have to play a game. Like, you could not be playing in front of less of your fans, and then also at a worse time.
Yeah, I don't know that many fans... We're going to make it just about anywhere. This was a North Carolina team that ended up losing to Kentucky in the Elite Eight. I believe Kendall Marshall was injured in that game, and that really cost them fairly dearly.
I just remember the whole game. Oh, God, who was there? Didn't they have, like, a pretty soft, like, freshman star?
Harrison Barnes?
Was it Harrison Barnes?
I guess it was his sophomore year that Kendall Marshall got hurt. I don't think it was actually this year, now that I think about it.
I just remember watching that game and being like, I feel like we're actually better than this team.
I mean, Kavai KenPom, they were number 16 and number 15. So,
man.
Basically equivalent teams. By the way, Michigan State actually turned out not to be that good that year, I think. I'm not seeing where they ended up in KenPom. Oh, they ended up number 45.
Wow.
So it's not quite as impressive as it looked. But that was a game the Huskies led, wow, literally the entire game until the final 2 minutes.
This felt like a Romar season. So this was the last great Romar year, right?
It was the last NCAA tournament Romar year. I mean,
man.
Well, you know, the next year was interesting.
Is it the Roten year? Is that 2012?
It is the Roten year.
Oh, my God.
It was Roten.
Just this, and I don't mean to say anything really negative about Lorenzo Romar here, because Lorenzo Romar led the Huskies to the highest possible peaks. This felt like a Romar team, whereas, like, the quintessential play was the cold-blooded shot, which was just Isaiah Thomas doing his thing. Like, I'm not going to say that Romar did anything for that, but, like, them not being able to get the ball in bounds against North Carolina, a baseline in bounds, and the Huskies being so completely incapable of doing that was just like, it always felt like, for whatever reason, with the Romar teams, like, they just were never, they never quite were able to do the last bits of being a really good team, like being like the precision that you needed. And I felt like that's always what the Romar teams lacked. It was like, they couldn't get an inbounds in at the end of that game. You know, it's like, why? What is wrong here? You know?
So, an interesting year for the Seahawks. That was the summer of the NFL lockout as well as the NBA lockout, as we'll talk about in a bit. After that concluded, Matt Hasselbeck signed with Tennessee as a free agent to mentor their first-round pick, Jake Locker. The Seahawks replaced him with Tarvaris Jackson, unfortunately RIP, as we discussed a few weeks ago, who had started in new offensive coordinator Daryl Bevel's offense in Minnesota. The Seahawks started 2-6, including a 6-3 loss at Cleveland in week 7 with Charlie Whitehurst at quarterback that mercifully we did not see.
Yes. I think it's generally considered to be, maybe aside from some Arizona games, one of the worst games of the Pete Carroll era. And we were driving back. Wow, so this was the year we drove to Stanford.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
We were in the car after that game driving back, and we might have been listening on the radio. Like, I'll be totally honest here, we didn't pay that much attention to the Seahawks this year.
That is correct. There was more attention paid to Red Zone and our fantasy football teams in all likelihood.
I think there was something about the like previous seasons that made us pretty jaded about the Seahawks. And this was like, I remember we were playing Salad Bowl one time and one of the clues was suck for luck. And we wanted to see it, which is hilarious because the Seahawks ended up with a better quarterback in that draft. But it was like, we felt like as conscientious NFL fans, like the Seahawks should tank for a year.
Yeah, I mean, there seemed to be two great quarterback prospects in that year's draft, neither of which were the ones the Seahawks drafted, who is clearly the best quarterback from that draft. So things worked out. The team found stride in the second half of the season, winning 5 out of 6 games, including a Thursday Night Football blowout of the Philadelphia Eagles' quote-unquote dream team that year.
Oh, my God.
As you'll recall, to reach 7-7 and have an outside chance at a playoff berth. They then lost 19-17 to the 49ers on Christmas Eve to fall out of playoff contention before losing a meaningless finale at Arizona in overtime to finish 7-9.
And that game I have no recollection of at all. That Thursday night game, again, it's so weird how little attention we paid. I feel like we just like needed a year off from the Seahawks or something. But in hindsight, it was maybe one of the – not the most – it was an extremely fun season because you could see that – like the defense that would lead them to a Super Bowl was coming together this year.
Right. It was like almost all of the pieces were in place. And then there was, you know, even though Travaris Jackson did an adequate job as a starting quarterback, there was this one big hole left to fill. And that was going to happen. But yeah, I mean, the defense improved from 29th to 10th in DVOA as the Seahawks overall improved from 30th as NFC West champions in 2010 to 19th. And the key addition, of course, the Legion of Boom taking shape with fifth-round pick Richard Sherman becoming a starter midway through his rookie season. And the rest was history.
I remember that there – so on that game, it was somewhere around midseason. Maybe it was before that Philadelphia game that Marshawn got good, right? The fabled story was that I think Tom Cable told Marshawn – like how to run in a zone scheme. Am I remembering that correctly?
I don't remember that specifically.
It was like Tom Cable was like, you need to wait and find the holes in the zone scheme. And then for whatever reason, like Marshawn Lynch was not a good running back for most of his career before halfway through the season. And then whatever happened, it just clicked halfway through. And it was like, even though the beast quake happened, like he wasn't a good running back on the Seahawks in that season, the half season that he spent with them before then.
He averaged 3.5 yards per carry in 2010.
I mean, it's pretty incredible how things change for him. I mean, if we're being a running backs don't matter perspective, the offensive line probably got a lot better. And then also the passing game got a lot better to free up holes for Marshawn Lynch to become a better runner. But like, it did happen pre-Russell Wilson, where like, that Philadelphia game, the carry that he had where he runs – this was a home game. I didn't have season tickets this year. And he runs into that like scrum of players and then just emerges out the other side. It was like – even now, like I wish that I'd seen it in person. It's one of the most incredible carries I've ever seen. Just like, where did he come from? You know, do you know the play that I'm talking about?
I don't remember that play specifically. I'm not sure if I watched that entire game because I that night was headed to the Seattle University game where they were hosting Stanford.
We should go through the amount of meaningless college basketball games that you went to instead of watching Seahawks games.
I mean, I watched the first half of it at least, and I was at Oscars, which, by the way, 2011 is the year of Oscars.
Wow.
Oh, RIP, poor one out.
Is it gone?
Oscars?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's been gone for like 5 years. Where have you been?
Not at Oscars.
Clearly. No one has.
But I do remember Christmas Eve, though, against the 49ers. That game was like, I felt like it was the moment, you know, when you're like not paying attention to something and everybody else is like, this is great. And then you're just like, oh, fuck, what have I been missing out on? I'm an idiot. I didn't watch season one of Game of Thrones. Like, all of a sudden you're just like, well, oh, everybody else was right and I'm dumb. And I think it was that Christmas Eve game against the Niners where I was like, Wait, I know Travaris Jackson is the quarterback, and I'm upset that they're not going to get a good draft pick or whatever, but, like, this football team is actually really fun.
Yeah, it was exciting. I mean, we were fired up for that game, and not necessarily in a way that, like, we were upset when they lost. It definitely didn't ruin our Christmas that they lost it, but it was like...
No, this wasn't a Cardinals game.
And those 49ers, I should say, were really good. I think that was the year that they were the number one seed in the NFC and lost the NFC Championship game.
To the Packers?
To the Saints, right?
Oh, they lost that, like, shootout game to the Saints, and we were at Angelo's while it was happening?
Correct. I think that's that year. Over the last nine games, by the way, Marshawn Lynch, 941 yards, 4.5 yards per carry. So, yeah, he definitely got it at that point. And, they beat the Saints in the divisional round. They lost the conference championship to the New York Football Giants.
Oh, man. Wow. Future Hall of Famer Eli Manning.
I want you to put some respect on the 2011-12 Stanford Cardinal, who had four NBA players on that roster.
I'm just saying, I'm not talking about the individual teams. I'm talking about the programs in general. Does that make sense?
Fine.
Stanford is not a rival of UW men's basketball.
No, this wasn't UW. You missed that. I was at Seattle U versus
No, I know.
Stanford.
Oh, you're saying I should put some respect that you were going to go view Stanford play against Seattle U? Hmm. Great. Hmm. Yeah, good one. I remember when this happened for Dwight Powell. I was playing against Marshawn Lynch in fantasy, and I was furious about how good he was playing. I'm willing to admit this because I was like, Marshawn Lynch fucking sucks. Why is he playing so good? I think he scored like three touchdowns in that Eagles game.
He definitely had two.
This was, at the time, my worst fantasy year ever. That's what I remember 2011 for.
Yeah, 22 carries, 148 yards, two touchdowns in that one from Marshawn Lynch. All right, so we mentioned earlier the trip to Stanford. That, sadly, was not to go see Dwight Powell in company. That was to see
Dwight Powell. We're like, let's hit the road, boys. We're going to see Dwight Powell.
Which found its stride offensively that year. So this was Keith Price taking over as starting quarterback from Jake Locker. He had made one start the year before. They survived a scare from future CFL Most Outstanding Player Bull Levi Mitchell in Eastern Washington to win the opener 30-27. Then lost 51-38 at number 11 Stanford. They started Pac-10.
Nebraska, not Stanford.
I'm sorry, yes, Nebraska. They started Pac-10 play 3-0 and entered the top 25. It is always terrible when the Huskies enter the top 25 before they go play at Stanford.
Oh, my God.
It's the same thing that happened before the Toby Gerhart game a couple of years ago. This time they're going to play at number 7 Stanford, Andrew Lux, senior year. We caravaned down to stay with our cousin Chris and his wife, and go to this game. They were in Davis, drive down to Palo Alto for the game. And it was a very pleasant tailgate. Lovely day. The campus is beautiful. The game was not so great.
The campus is beautiful?
Oh, Stanford's campus is very attractive.
No, thank you. Not for me. Not for me, boss. We were tailgating in, like, it's called the farm, right?
It is, yes.
We were tailgating on, like, I mean, not that it's, like, great confines tailgating at UW, but, like, I remember we were just sort of, like, backed into a dusty road.
I think we were on grass, as I recall it. But also there was, like, the palm trees. It was pleasant.
I will say, this was in October, right?
Yes, October 22nd.
Northern California, in mid-October. Freaking incredible. So I will give it up for that. The drive down there of, like, having a sunny drive, and you're like, damn, it is 80 degrees. First ever time that I ever had Pliny the Elder.
Yeah. We just, like, went to the co-op and picked it up because that's the thing you can do in Northern California.
Isn't that crazy? We came back and we had In-N-Out.
Yep.
This was the first ever time that I had a Neapolitan shake from In-N-Out. Which I remember was really pretty life-altering, probably. I think we were in a car together, so that was pretty incredible.
We actually were not in a car together.
You might have told me about it beforehand. I don't know.
I recall that I rode with Chris.
I think this was the first ever time that I like really got in and out. Like it made sense to me, you know?
Full page ad. You're welcome.
You and everybody else.
Well, I was the one who explained it to you. So the game itself, Huskies are down, are in it early. Get a 46-yard touchdown run from Chris Polk, followed by a 61-yard touchdown run from Chris Polk.
There we go.
They're trailing 17-14 early in the second quarter. Stanford then reels off 31 unanswered points. A lot of big plays in this one. A 70-yard touchdown run from Stephon Taylor and a 62-yard interception return from Michael Thomas as Stanford took a 48-14 lead en route to a 65-21 victory. This is a team that like barely passed with Andrew Luck because they didn't even need to. He was 16 of 21 for 169 yards and 2 touchdowns.
Andrew Luck never really like roasted the Huskies. It was more just like he did exactly as much as he had to.
God, they ran 44 times for 446 yards and 5 touchdowns in this one.
Jesus Christ.
Two guys, both Stephon Taylor and Tyler Gaffney, were over 100 yards. And they had a third running back rush for 93 yards. Man, Harvard-Stanford teams were something.
I should never go to Road Husky. I've never been to a winning Road Husky game. I've only been to two. I've been to Stanford and Oregon, and they were both horrible losses.
My experience on the road has not been quite as negative as that. Although I guess Cal is the only the Apple Cup win in 2000.
Didn't you go to a terrible Colorado loss this year?
It wasn't a great Colorado loss, but I blame that more on, you know, this year's team than on me being there. I also went to the UNLV game, the Boise State game in the Las Vegas Bowl.
Oh, so you did go to a positive one. You also went to the Rose Bowl where they lost to. Man, when I think back on losing to Dwayne Haskins, I'm just like, him?
It wasn't just Dwayne Haskins.
I know.
There were some other guys.
I know.
The Huskies lost 3 in a row late in Pac-10 play. The final game at Husky Stadium against number 6 Oregon before renovations. Then at number 18 USC. And then at Oregon State with Nick Montana starting at quarterback.
For which team?
For UW. He was back at Peace Price that season.
I feel like he could have easily transferred to Montana by this time. Where did he end up transferring to?
Nick Montana. I think there might have been multiple stops on the Nick Montana tour. Let's see here. Ended up at Tulane.
Oh.
Yeah, played 2 seasons at Tulane. So then they rallied. The final game of the regular season was the Apple Cup at CenturyLink Field, which the Huskies would call home in 2012, beating Wazoo 38-21. So with 2 Pac-10 teams, again in the BCS, both Stanford and Oregon, and USC still bowl ineligible, the 7-5 Huskies.
There we go.
Number 15 Baylor and RG3 in the Alamo Bowl. One of the wildest college football games. Like,
this was fun, too.
Big 12 games like this over the years, but they lost 67-56 despite 430 yards from Keith Price. Jermaine Kearse had 198 receiving yards in his final UW game, and Price became the second player in UW history to throw for 3,000 yards in a season and set a new school record with 33 touchdowns.
Kind of incredible how UW, I feel like, not consecutively, maybe consecutively? We go Keith Price. There was one season in between Keith Price and Jake Browning, right?
There was a Siler Miles season.
Yes, it was Siler Miles. Okay. 2 consecutive extremely underrated quarterbacks, both who kind of faded in their senior years. Kind of strange how Keith Price and Jake Browning had...
Price faded in his junior year.
And then he got better in the senior year.
Correct. It turns out it's almost like UW has really, like, way too high standards for quarterbacks. He thinks that tall quarterbacks with pale complexion are better than
pale
they are.
Pale complexion.
Fancy that.
The Husky team was 7-5, but they were not, I don't think talent-wise, all that different from Baylor. I mean, they were different because Baylor had one of the best players in the country, but like across the board talent-wise, UW probably had a better team.
I mean, they did have a lot of talent on that team, as it turned out.
Like, but that was also one of the most fun games to watch. I mean, I still think if RG3 never gets hurt, RG3 is like a revolutionary quarterback.
I mean, his rookie season was incredible.
RG3, his extremely short relevance of an NFL career, is he's underrated of just how exciting RG3 was for a period of time. Like, after that year, I think people liked Luck. I mean, it was a legit conversation between Luck, Russ, and RG3. And it was like, you could have easily made an argument that RG3 was the best of the players.
No, this was not a Josh Gordon. I don't know if it was a Josh Gordon team, but it was not a good Josh Gordon game. He didn't. Let's see. He didn't play at all that season. He may already have been kicked off the team by that point. But their backup quarterback was Bryce Petty. They had Kendall Wright with their leading receiver.
Yeah, Kendall Wright.
1,663 yards that year. And Terrence Ganaway, who I think played for the Cowboys, right? Had in that game that. He had 21 carries for 200 yards and 5 touchdowns. This was, by the way, this is one of the memories of this year. I remember writing like a blog post that blew up about this. This was the year that like the Nick Holt bandwagon really, you know, lost a tire, I guess. I don't know. Spun out. Nick Holt, highest paid defensive coordinator in the Pac-10, and the Huskies defense was so bad.
Really, I think if we looked back on it, you'd probably say there was quite a bit of talent on that defense, too.
Yeah, I mean, Danny Shelton, Desmond Trufant.
Two first-round picks.
Yeah, this seemed to be the most notable, like, players who eventually, yeah, but still.
But that game, just constant scoring. Like, I remember just, like, instantly, it's just like, oh, somebody scored a touchdown. And it was just back and forth the entire game. Like, it was what people fear football will look like. people are like, oh, it's just like flag football nowadays. Those people, those types.
Yeah.
This is what they hate. And it was one of the best games we've seen.
Yeah. It was another one of those, like, you can't be that upset they lost. They were leading with 9:40 left in the game.
I mean, it's also a bowl game. You never really could be that upset that they lost the Alamo Bowl. It doesn't really matter. It's just like, but they were also playing RG3. It was great. It was fun. We got to be there.
Well, I mean, they got to be there. We weren't there. We were at Katie's house. The Sounders three-peated in the U.S. Open Cup, joining the Fall River Marksmen from 1929 through 31 and the New York Greek Americans from 1967 through 69 as teams to win three consecutive Open Cups in the storied history of that competition. They won three games at Starfire before beating the Chicago Fire 2-0 in the final at the Click.
The Greek Americans sounds way too politically correct for 1967 and 1969.
What were you expecting them to have been?
I don't know. I'm just saying. Like
an ethnic slur?
Yes.
It was referring to themselves. They named it. The Sounders advanced in the CONCACAF Champions League for the first time that year, beating Panamanian side San Francisco before finishing second to Monterrey in their group to reach the championship round in 2012. The Sounders started slowly in MLS play, but won 7 of their final 9 matches to finish second in the West before again losing in the West semifinals, giving up 3 goals at RSL in the opener and clawing back just 2 of them in the home leg. So definitely an element of Groundhog Day settling in for the Sounders as they continually won the U.S. Open Cup but lost in the first round of the MLS playoffs.
Yep.
Season also notable for a friendly visit by Manchester United, which won 7-0 behind a Wayne Rooney hat trick. What happened in this one is like Man U saved all their best players for the second half, and the Sounders took all their starters out at halftime, and it got real ugly.
Did I go to that?
Possibly.
I remember going to a Chelsea match. Was that?
Chelsea was when we had season tickets, about Chelsea and Barcelona.
I don't think I went to that one, to the Man U match. I might
never
have
watched it on TV.
Can I say one more thing about Husky football, though? And this is a controversial take. Because I think he's generally regarded as an asshat, Chip Kelly. But I always felt like in that last game at UW, Oregon, did they go to the BCS championship this year?
No, I think it was the year before they went to the BCS championship.
Oregon was so much better than UW this year. I mean, they could have beaten us by whatever margin they wanted to. And I felt like it was a very, like, gentleman-like victory, considering that it was the last win at Husky, the last game at Husky Stadium. I was it felt intentional by Chip Kelly, where he was, like, respecting the history of the stadium.
So they won they beat Stanford for the North that year, winning 53-30 at number 3 Stanford, and then won the Pac-12 championship over, I guess, by the 2000, these are different seasons. It had become the Pac-12 by the 2011 football season, even though it wasn't as if the 2011 basketball season, and then beat number 9 Wisconsin 45-38 in the Rose Bowl.
Oh, I rewatched that like a month ago.
Young man named Russell Wilson.
Handing the ball
25.
Off so much.
Well, he had to get ready for it. 19 of 25 for 296 yards. Darren Thomas in that one, 17 of 23, 268, 3 touchdowns for Oregon, which finished the year ranked number 4 in that UW game.
So this was pre-Mariota?
Yeah, they kicked a field goal with a minute 49 left. I guess they could have gone for a touchdown there?
I don't know.
Yeah, it was pre-Mariota.
What was the final score of that game?
34-17.
Oh, I just remember Oregon not really running up the score when it was like they easily could have.
So the Huskies had gotten within one. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's 1:49 left in the third quarter, so maybe you are right about this.
They only scored 34 points against the Nick Holt defense when they were Oregon.
This is an excellent point.
Baylor scored 68 points. 67 points.
Part of it is because their defense was a little better. Keith Price must have gotten sacked a lot because he had 8 carries for minus 27 yards.
Oh, boy.
And threw for 143 yards.
I'm just remembering this as a takeaway I remember feeling in the moment a decade ago, you know?
Yes.
So.
All right, so the Seattle Storm coming off their championship in 2011 were stunned by Phoenix in the playoffs. They added future Hall of Famer Katie Smith to the roster, bolstering the defending champions, but started slowly after beating the Mercury in their opening game following the ring ceremony. Also, one of my favorite days, the combo of the ring ceremony in a nice matinee game, followed by U2 on a gorgeous Saturday night.
That was the night we went to see U2? Man, that actually
was.
I remember being like weirdly shocked at how good that U2 show was. I was like, damn, I like U2 a lot more than I thought I did. I was like Johnny Drama after.
They lost their next game 81-74 to Minnesota, falling behind 22-0 to start the game. So the Storm have a tradition, like many college basketball teams, where you stand until the team scores, and fans were standing through an entire timeout on this one. I remember it so vividly of like, oh God, what is happening? After playing poorly in the season's first 5 games, Lauren Jackson needed hip surgery, is announced while the Storm was at the White House collecting meeting President Obama, and missed 2 months. The Storm hovered around 500 without her, then won 8 of the final 9 after Lauren's return to finish 2nd in the West and faced the Mercury in the opening round, a rematch of the previous year's conference finals. They won the opener 80-61 but lost in Phoenix to force Game 3. Despite Diana Taurasi fouling out with 6:38 left, the Mercury still won at Key Arena on a Candace Dupree putback with 1.9 seconds left. And this was probably the single most devastating loss in my time working for the Storm.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I just remember the day after. The other one was Houston in 2005. Was the same thing where they won game one and then lost the next two to go out.
3-game series. Kind of brutal.
It is. But it was just like that whole time you were like, okay, they're going to find a way to win. They're going to find a way to win. Diana Taurasi's out of the game. Penny Taylor was awesome down the stretch of that one, even though she didn't score the winning bucket. And I just remember going to work the next day, just being in a daze. And I had my boss at that point was someone who wasn't a sports fan, really. And she was like, what is everyone so upset about? Just did not get it at all.
But she worked for the team.
Just didn't understand why we're so emotionally attached and invested.
It's still like, even from a business perspective, it's worse for her, right?
Yes. She was not the most emotional person I ever met.
Did I work there at the same time as them?
No, I don't think so.
Huh. I am looking forward to you just mentioning that the 2012 night of the 2012 election Wow, we're going to talk about the Macklemore moment next year.
Yes, we are. get ready.
I mean, 2012 election was like, it was, he was all wrapped up in it in Seattle.
The Mariners were bad again. Their first back-to-back losing seasons since 2005 and 2006. Felix dropped off a bit after his Cy Young season, and an anemic offense managed a league low 3.343 runs per game. About the only positive thing from this season was a strong rookie season from Michael Pineda, who made the All-Star team, going 9-10 with a 3.74 ERA.
And then so the Mariners traded. And then the Mariners traded. I loved Michael Pineda.
I mean, it ended up working out. Pineda, I don't think, was ever the same after it. He had Tommy John, right?
Yeah, and Jesus Montero is a star now.
Well, you know, it is still the Mariners. It is still the Mariners. I guess he didn't have Tommy John until 2017. So
I think
sure
he had like one monster year, or at least a few starts. And Montero had like, the Mariners tried to force him. I was playing fantasy baseball at this time. The Mariners, I remember having Pineda and him being good on the Mariners. And it's like, that's always a fun combo. I would say there's actually another internet question. It was like, who is one player who you loved who only played 1 year for your favorite team? And I hadn't thought about this before, but Pineda was definitely like, I really liked. He was probably the most that I liked a baseball player since the other one who came to mind instantly. I mean, Durant is maybe one. Who only played 1 year? Jose Cruz Jr., though.
Yeah, I had that thought, yeah.
That's the one where I was like, just if Jose Cruz Jr. would have played longer, same with Michael Pineda, on the Mariners, we would have liked them less.
Probably true.
So that's kind of part of it. But it was very sad to see Pineda go.
All right, so this was a year of the NBA lockout.
Wow, I don't even remember that NFL lockout.
I mean, it didn't miss any time. It just pushed back the offseason, a weird offseason. So, we're talking about the 2010-11 season before the lockout. The Blazers started 12-14 but still won 48 games despite, stop me if you've heard this before, a series of injuries. Greg Oden was ruled out for the season with microfracturing knee surgery on November 17th. While Brandon Roy's knees really caught up with him, he was sidelined for 2 months starting in December and returned as a backup to Wesley Matthews, played just 8 minutes in the Game 2 loss at Dallas as the Blazers went behind 2-0 in this first-round series that they were frequently picked to win, including by yours truly. Roy scored 16 points in Game 3, and then Game 4, a game we talked about when we inducted Roy into the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame a few weeks ago, that was the game where he has a huge fourth quarter. The day before Easter, the Blazers come back from a big deficit to tie the series. It was the last great moment for Brandon Roy in a basketball uniform, certainly in a Portland uniform. The Blazers lost the next two. Dallas went on to win the championship that year after I picked against them in the first round. And Brandon Roy never played in Portland again. He was amnestied after the lockout concluded.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dallas won the championship that year?
Yeah, they beat Miami.
Oh, that was the year that they beat Miami. I was thinking that they won the year that Katie and I lived together. Did they? No.
That was the year they lost in the finals to Miami.
Okay, so they played each other twice, like 4 years apart. They lost to the Shaq D-Wade Miami team and then beat in the first year of the LeBron, of the Big Three team.
Correct. All right, that's sports in 2011.
Man.
Should we talk about music?
Sure.
I would say 2011 is one of my favorite music years.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, at the top of the list here, an album that I feel like, I don't know if you agree with me, I feel like has been completely lost to history, but was the album I listened to by far the most in 2011 and held up stunningly strong on the re-listen, which is Watch the Throne.
I see some people occasionally talk about Watch the Throne. I don't know if I would say that it's been... It has been lost to history in as much as it's not like it's not considered a classic album by almost anybody. It's not like it's like a Pigeons and Planes album or something, you know, like they don't have it on their list of like you can only keep two or whatever. Watch the Throne's rarely on there. But I at the same time, I don't think it's regarded poorly. And the, like, some of the Jay-Z verse on No Church in the Wild, is that the song? There's a Jay-Z verse where I was like, I remember reading it and being like, oh, this is the best rapper on earth.
Which is interesting because his competition for that throne at that point was also on the album.
Oh, I mean, Kanye West has never been like, I'm talking like purely as a rapper.
I see what you're saying, yes.
And like, is Pius Pius, because God loves Pius, Socrates ass, whose bias do y'all seek? It was just like, Jay-Z was on another level. And it's like, you have like early Frank, Hove, Kanye. I remember listening to it like right when it came out, the whole record. And there are definitely moments where it's like, this is up there with the densest that Jay-Z got, I feel like, in a good way. The record in general, like, you kind of thought going, you're like, whoa, Kanye and Jay-Z together? You're like, this is going to be all hits. And then
yes,
there were some hits, but it felt like they had to force it, right? Like,
a little bit.
Otis was one that right away was just like, okay, yep, yeah, that's great. But it was just like the sample was really what stood out from it, you know? Right. And then the song's called Otis. But then being at the show, like, I remember I listened to the record probably a lot because I knew the songs, but I didn't know them in the way that I would know the songs on a Kanye album, whereas, like, I know every part of it. And then going to that show at the Tacoma Dome, a Friday night in Tacoma, which is just, like, never a good situation when you have to get to Tacoma on a Friday night. It's never a good situation going to Tacoma on any weekday, but, like, I remember driving down there. I think we felt like we were late, but then, of course, the show started crazy late. And over
this
time...
This was you separately. I went with the famous Cousin Katie, so we watched UW play UC Santa Barbara and win 87-80. We watched that on TV at some bar.
You two who are borderline unemployed, you could just fucking...
Well,
go to Tacoma at whatever time you want to go to Tacoma.
Okay.
On a Friday.
Okay. This was 9 days before the start of the NBA season after the lockout. So I was at that point finishing up the pro basketball prospectus book that came out the following Monday and also preparing to host a Christmas party on Sunday. So
put a little respect right on me
being busy for this one. But I had been listening to Watch the Throne that was like the soundtrack of me writing that year's pro basketball prospectus.
Really?
Also, by the way, we haven't mentioned it this year, but this was the year that you lived here.
Wow. I lived there.
A weird time.
I mean, I lived there for like a month.
It was longer than that, I think.
Was it?
I think it was a solid couple months.
Possibly it was. I think I moved in. Well, no, it was basically just the month of November. I moved
in. No, you must have been there in October, right?
Well,
I'm sure you were here in October.
I moved in on Halloween weekend, I think. You think I was there the entire time? Maybe it was 2 months. I moved into my house on December 1st.
Yeah, because I remember you moving in right after the storm season ended.
Maybe it was all of October and all of November. It's funny because, like, we lived together but didn't interact with each other all that much.
Nope.
That was really the origins of the Pelton cast. We're going to rewrite history.
A defining memory is, like, you got me into watching Sunny. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. I had never watched before that. And
yeah.
Then also The League, which came on after that.
Yep, that was a good time for It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. They had the Hurricane episode that we all watched together. And I think Jan watched it with us, too. But I just had no expectations for the show, you know? And then... was freaking blown away. Whereas, like, oh,
it
was one of those moments where I'm like, oh yeah, this is Jay-Z and Kanye, like, doing Jay-Z and Kanye hits and also doing Watch the Throne. Like, why was I not excited for this? I was like, I would be excited for Jay-Z or Kanye. Why would I not be doubly excited for them together? I think it was just having to drive to Tacoma. But getting there,
makes sense.
And then so they go through, and I remember every Watch the Throne song, and like I had no real expectations for them, and I was like, wow, that track bangs, that track bangs. It's like, oh my god. And then the very end, so this was the peak of when they were doing In Paris over and over and over again. Just being right, like...
Let me quote from the Wikipedia. Originally performed 3 times in a row, but as the tour progressed, the song was regularly performed up to 10 times in succession, with the record being 11 times in Paris.
Oh, that's when they did it 11 times?
Yep.
Wow. When Kanye goes, when he does the again, and you're just like, do it, Kanye.
I didn't want it to ever stop. I apparently tweeted about this.
Really?
In 2011. And not going to lie, disappointed we only got 5 renditions.
Oh, we only got 5. Figured I was going to guess that we had 8.
It would really get good around number 7 or 8. That tweet posted at 12:10 a.m. on December 17th.
I would have definitely taken 8 in a row. So we only got 5.
Yeah.
Hmm. What a disappointment.
I'm going to get my money back.
That was like one of the most brilliant things that was ever conceived, though. Where they were, and the track became a mass. It's the biggest song from the album, and I feel like this definitely was part of the story. Where they're just like, you don't recognize this song is a hit, and we are going to force you to recognize that this song is a hit.
I feel like people had already recognized. I think you're exaggerating that.
Them doing it over and over and over again was definitely part of it, though. Like it pushed it. It pushed the story forward. Yes. Mrs. Fantasy Genius agrees.
Okay, so the other notable, another notable music thing that year. The date was November 15th, 2011. New albums. Both Take Care from Drake and Camp from Childish Gambino dropping on the same day.
Well, you're acting like these were comparable things, which maybe in 2020 these are comparable things. But like Camp was an indie album when it came out.
But we were pretty fucking excited about Camp. I don't remember.
Hated it. I will tell you. Pitchfork destroyed this record, and I remember reading that before listening to it, and then I was so clouded by that, and they were like, God, where's the Pitchfork review? They gave it a 1.6. Wow. Which probably, I feel like it only like adds to the story. And I remember reading, like, Childish Gambino was not, like, he was a big artist, but we're talking 1/1000th where he is now, you know? And
I don't know if I'd go that far.
Sold 242,000 copies. Jesus Christ. But it's still, we're talking very, very far off from like one of the biggest hip hop pop artists in the world. It was not there. But I had read that review and I was just like, this music is fucking terrible. Because I'd read the like super negative review before I listened to it. So I was totally clouded on the record.
Gambino backlash.
I remember listening to it. I was just like, I'd kind of written him off. And then the next record came out, and I was like, oh, like, I remember listening to 3005, and I was like, oh, I might have been wrong, or Pitchfork was wrong, or whatever, you know?
First off, under any circumstance, assume you were wrong. I would say I like the story he tells at the end of the album that's on That Power as much as almost anything that he's done musically.
What is the story? I don't even know.
It's a story about like summer camp, which is the name, like hence the name of the album.
Wow. So. Spin gave Because the Internet a 2 out of 10. I feel like it was chic to shit on Childish Gambino's music, and then now it's probably chic to try to get him to do a fucking interview with you.
Now it's chic to shit on Drake's music.
Is it?
I don't know.
Just the tussie slide. Come on.
Well,
it's terrible.
But I feel like Take Care is like Drake. I don't know if I want to say perfecting, but he took his formula to a new level here.
Oh, this is the Drake record. Well, I don't actually. I'm going to take that back. It's the next one.
There are a lot of the Drake records.
Nothing was the same as when that was when Drake. That's like the full vision of Drake. When he fully achieved, like when, I'm sure this was in your top songs of the decade or whatever, he hadn't fully achieved pop stardom as he did with Hold On, We're Going Home, quite on Take Care.
I mean, the motto is pretty high up there.
It's still a rap song, you know?
Fair. I feel like, so the title track. Like,
you only live once. You get... Man, people are saying YOLO 2011.
I know. YOLO. Anytime you get Drake and Rihanna together for a duet, that's like right in my sweet spot. But the most memorable song on this album for me is Marvin's Room.
Really?
And that's because of a thing that happened in late June 2011.
What? I'm so ready for this.
Which is that Jason Richardson tweeted about me.
What? How does this have to do with Drake?
Wait for it. I had written a story for ESPN Insider talking about free agents that I thought teams should be careful with their offers to because they might not age particularly well. And without context, on June 27th, 2011, Jason Richardson tweets from at JRich23, who the hell is Kevin Pelton? A great moment as people tried to figure out why we were beefing.
Mm-hmm.
Which was pretty one-sided. I thought this was hilarious.
Uh-huh. Beefing.
And to try to play it off, I replied to him, is this because his previous tweet had been about whether you'd like more Marvin's Room or some other song from this album? And my reply was, is this because I didn't like Marvin's Room? Which it turns out actually Marvin's Room is great. I do like Marvin's Room. I hadn't heard it at the time I tweeted this. But this was definitely like a big thing on a tiny sector of the internet for a couple days there.
Ah, so good. I mean,
Trust Issues was the other one, which didn't end up making the album, actually. That didn't come out until Care Package.
Wow, look at that. Yeah. To me, you've got Gil Scott-Heron, Jamie XX, Drake, and Rihanna on Take Care. Like, just everything. Everything you could be looking for.
I wasn't done talking about Jane Rich.
You weren't what?
I wasn't done talking about Jay Rich.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Go ahead. There's
so he
four.
Ended up signing a four-year, $25 million contract after the lockout. The Magic then dumped his contract on the Sixers after one season as part of the Dwight Howard trade, and he played just 52 games the remainder of his career due to injury.
You're taking a victory lap on Jason Richardson right now?
I'm just giving you the facts.
Didn't he tweet it again? Who the hell is Kevin Pelton?
He did, because I said I didn't think he was going to play again after he had the surgery to implant new cartilage in his knee.
He clearly knew who you were the second time he tweeted about it.
No, there's no way he remembered.
So is he tweeting who the hell is X often?
This time he just said, who is Kevin Pelton the second time?
Why is it just you? I'm sorry, but there's a theme to this. He either says it about everybody, or he actually knew who you were, and he was trying to develop a running joke.
I just don't think he would remember it from 3 years earlier. He has not tweeted who the hell very often, only two times, according to this.
What was the other time? Oh my god. Please let it be who the hell is Dan Devine.
I know. At AT&T store and found out my 10-year-old daughter is $300 over on text message. Who the hell is she texting? Definitely getting call from dad tomorrow. LOL.
Wow, it's reserved for you in the AT&T store?
No, I think that was for his daughter.
Oh, man.
And it's the only time he ever tweeted who is in that then context. I don't know, man.
Jason Richardson is like, he either has like a long-term grudge against you, or he was trying to build up like a really hilarious like repeating joke. Jay Rich was going to be
was
like,
quite so funny when I saw it again, although it wasn't the same kind of sensation because it wasn't who the hell is Kevin Pelton. That's just got a great ring to it.
Who the hell and is naturally, Kevin
Pelton? Naturally, when that book.
When was the last time you retweeted that?
I haven't since 2011.
You might want to go back and do that again sometime soon.
I'm probably going to tweet about this discussion, I would say. The book that I mentioned the next year, the Pro Basketball Prospectus, the author bio said, who the hell is Kevin Pelton? And then went into the bio.
Oh, man. I love that you just took a victory lap on Jay Rich, too. Not cool.
I just shared the facts. I'm not saying I'm happy he got injured. I'm not that. I wanted him to stay healthy. So other music in 2011.
It really felt like 2011 was the hip-hop kind of as we know it for the next decade. A lot of it happening kind of early phases here. I mean, you have the Goblin album by Tyler, the Creator. Like Odd Future's taking over the world and like what we consider like cool hip-hop R&B internet music really starts around this time period. This is the first time I think we've talked about Odd Future.
Yeah, I don't think their mixtape doesn't come out until 2012, technically.
But this is the beginning of it.
Yes. Frank Ocean self-released Nostalgia Ultra in 2011.
Nostalgia Ultra came out in 2011?
Yeah, I guess I missed this because it was an official release.
Okay.
Novocaine, yeah, I missed this.
Yeah, I was scrolling through every album, but like, I think this was before then. Maybe Yonkers had come out. I think it was earlier. I'd gotten holds at the Vera Project. Yeah, because Bastard came out in 2009. I'd gotten holds of the Vera Project for a group called Odd Future that I never heard of. And this is the Vera Project, of all places. Odd Future was like, people on the internet loved them, Tyler, the Creator, or they hated him, right? This was not like Tyler, the Creator as he's perceived now, right? Like Tyler, the Creator version 2.0. It was like he was scary at the time, but also exciting. And I remember having a conversation with the agent, which the show has never happened, the Vera Project, but like having a conversation with the agent just being like, dude, I can't do this, you know? I was like, that this place, I cannot do this show. I was like, it would be extremely exciting, but it is not happening here at this inclusive space because Tyler, the Creator was scary. By 2011, we had a better sense of who everybody was as individuals. You know, like we knew, we had a better sense of like, Earl was like a little bit less like distant or whatever, you know, he was like back from his being banished, and it was like we knew who Odd Future was by then. But when Nostalgia Ultra came out, I remember downloading it because it was a free download, and they had the sample of the Eagles on American Wedding, and I remember playing it in my office and people in my office shitting on it. I was like, I think you might be wrong here. You know, it's one of those things where you listen to it for the first time and people being like, what is this? And people who consider themselves to be hipsters and I'm sure fucking love Frank Ocean now. And I was just like, I think you might be wrong. This might be incredible. And like, from that day forward, I was like, I think this dude might be great. Like, I'll still, American Wedding's not like available anywhere except for YouTube, but I'll just pull up the YouTube and listen to it at least 5 times a year. It's the perfect song.
Okay.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't remember American Wedding.
Man.
I remember Novocaine, certainly.
Well, Novocaine was actually released as a single. Like.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Nostalgia Ultra was the first independent release from the most important artist of the last decade.
Oh. You okay there?
I'm just bothered that I didn't see that on there. But I also want to mention, you mentioned November 15th as the date that Take Care came out, plus Camp, also a week earlier, Blue Slide Park by Mac Miller, the debut album from Mac Miller, which again, talking about artists who like would shape what hip hop would look like for the next 10 years after that. Mm-hmm. And the most insane Vera Project show that maybe ever existed. I think this was in like, I think this was in 2011. He just had mixtapes out and should have, again, way, way, way too big to be playing in a venue with no security whatsoever. I walked in, and like Mac Miller initially started out as like a weed rapper, like friend of Wiz Khalifa. And I was at the Vera Project Gala. It was happening the same night as the Mac Miller show. It was insanely sold out, like hundreds plus more people over capacity. And I walked into the balcony after the gala, and I stood there, and there was just a cloud of smoke over the crowd. And I was just like, Jesus Christ. Somebody had like broken a door because they were upset about not being able to get in. I walked outside and Grinch was standing there outside, high as fuck or whatever. And I'm just like, dude, what happened? He's like, yeah, man, it's crazy. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to have to deal with a bunch of bullshit because of this, which I did.
Well, there you go. All right, what else from 2011?
Well, I wanted to comment on one of your notes in the notes, and you put Bon Iver debut, which I have to say, so the record self-titled Bon Iver came out in 2011, and uh-huh. I'm so sorry, you've been exposed as listening to dad rock but not actually having children. If you think self-titled Bon Iver by Bon Iver is the debut record.
I thought you had mentioned it being their debut. That was my, why I put it. And you had looked and said, oh, that was 2011. But I guess I misremembered what you said.
Exposed. You think you're into dad rock and you don't remember Forever Ago?
You know that my dad rock is more in the Death Cab. Where the
you're like a little bit M.O.R., a little bit like middle of the road dad rock. Bon Iver is a little bit too edgy for you.
I enjoyed listening to the self-titled album when I did.
Probably in 2015.
No, it might have been in 2020.
Oh, wow. Look, if you had kids, you would have listened to that in 2011, and you would have been like, oh, pretty solid follow-up. That's what you would have said. You'd had your like Cafe Vita cup in your hand and been like, really pushing the sound forward there.
Oh, and Helplessness Blues. I don't know if that qualifies as dad rock, but
you just listened to that too?
No.
Oh my god.
That's I'm saying that's what I was listening to instead.
Well, I'm gonna say I'm surprised you didn't call that the Fleet Fox's debut album.
I'm aware of when Fleet Fox's debuted. We talked about it. We literally talked about it on the podcast.
That's all that really stands out to me music-wise from 2011, but
all right.
Well, I'm sure we've been talking for like 5 hours.
It's definitely true. On the TV front, 2011 marked the debut of a show called Game of Thrones that I also have not watched.
I'm sure that you haven't. God, the show that's after it. Jesus Christ.
Something else I was busy watching instead.
On Game of Thrones for a moment, a lot of people have commented lately, because we just passed the one-year anniversary of the finale of Game of Thrones, and it's kind of incredible. I didn't think this was possible, to be honest. How forgotten culturally Game of Thrones has been in the last year.
I mean, I just listened to a podcast about Game of Zones, so I don't feel like it's that forgotten.
What is the Game of Zones podcast about? Can you explain this to me?
Well, Game of Zones is a video series.
Okay.
That is parodying Game of Thrones with NBA people.
Okay.
But the creators of it were on Zach Lowe's podcast last week.
Are they still making Game of Zones?
This was the finale. I mean, they're a year behind, basically.
And they parody Game of Thrones?
Yes.
Okay, well, I'm saying in general, like, there are certain shows that continue to exist in the culture. Like, you constantly see whatever, I mean, newer things, but, like, you constantly see Succession memes and things like that, SpongeBob, stuff like that. I see people talking about Game of Thrones and posting memes about Game of Thrones so little. And I feel like, I mean, in 2011, I remember Third Pelton Brother Reese got, like, the DVDs or something of season one. And then I think he read every single book after that. He read like 40,000 pages of book. And I remember talking to him being like, oh, what are you up to? And he was like, I'm just going to be at home reading Game of Thrones. And me being like, I was just like, what the fuck is this thing? Like, what are you talking about? And I started watching season one in like January 2012. And then it's one of those things where you watch the first episode and you're like, all right, I want to watch every single episode of this TV show forever and ever. But if you don't, until you're in, it's hard to be in. But like I remember reading at the end of 2011, a review of the best TV episodes of 2011. And there was a Game of Thrones episode in there, probably the first episode. And they were talking how brilliant it was. I was like, man, I got to see the show or whatever. And then obviously it became a cultural phenomenon. But this was, it's interesting how that can happen with like IP that it was around in the world. You know what I mean? Like Game of Thrones had been around for a decade plus before this. And I just had never heard of it. But there obviously were so many people who were fans of it, and then by becoming a TV show, became a cultural phenomenon instantly, basically. Especially by season two.
Much the same as a show that debuted in 2011. Franklin and Bash!
No.
Launching Camille and Johnny's career.
Was he Bash or Franklin?
He was neither Bash nor Franklin.
No.
I'm pretty sure Franklin was Breckenmeyer.
It was Breckenmeyer and Mark Falgasser. Camille Nanjiani's career was definitely launched before this.
I'm joking.
He was on a Chappelle show sketch.
Wait, was he?
Yeah.
I don't remember that. Another thing I remember.
He's on the sketch where you're like buying a cell phone and Camille Nanjiani is. That was quite a bit earlier.
You sure that's not Portlandia?
Oh, maybe that is Portlandia, sorry.
Which also debuted in 2011, coincidentally. Have we talked Portlandia much on this podcast?
I don't think really at all.
It was such an on-the-nose parody or satire, I guess, of something that was ripe to be satirized. Is that the right term? I don't know. And the main thing about Portlandia, though, is so they filmed it, Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein from Sleater-Kinney, during the summer in Portland. And so they air these episodes during like the winter in like January and February.
Yeah, they debuted in January.
And it would be so sunny and beautiful in Portland. It was like, how do I go to that place? Yes. Because it doesn't exist right now. I want to go there right now. I think 2012 was when we went to the Portlandia live show, right?
That seems about right, yeah.
I think that would have been around the start of season two.
The very, very, very beginning of Portlandia, the first episode, everything about it felt perfect.
The first episode was at the farm-to-table, like,
yeah.
What was the origin of this?
I mean, the first ever sketch was The Dream of the 90s is Alive in Portland.
Oh, yeah.
And then I remember going, God, I don't remember what year, maybe 2012? I drove with Chris to Berkeley to go to an Atmosphere at the Greek Theater in Berkeley. And we stopped in Portland on the way down and stopped at like an old timey themed bar in Portland. And it was just like, oh yeah, this is what Portland is. You know, it's like, yeah, this all checks out. If I know anything about Portlandia, this is dead on. But that the dream of the 1890s is alive in Portland was like, It was perfect. It was exactly what we were looking for. And then the washed out theme too, like when they that, the feel it all around, and then people are like doing wacky shit in Portland in the theme, it's like, God damn, I want to be there. But yeah, Portland summers, like I haven't been to Portland that much in the summer, but
I mean I haven't really. I mean,
it's not that different than Seattle in the summer, where it's just like the best place on earth is the Pacific Northwest in the summer.
Yeah, it's not a Portland versus Seattle statement. It's a Northwest in the summer versus Northwest in the winter statement.
Exactly. Yeah, despite whichever place you move to, Chris Wheeler, like it's the right decision over the summer, either one.
All right, on the movie front,
he moved to Seattle. I hope that you're having a great time.
I don't know if he's here yet. Mm. I That may have been delayed by the, you know, the pandemic. 2012 brought us Moneyball, the movie.
Okay, never heard of it.
Oh, really?
No.
And Bridesmaids.
Two movies I definitely did not see in the year 2011.
I went to go see Moneyball in the theater. That was like probably the only movie I saw in a theater in like a 5-year span.
Really? I really look back on this as like, this was just before I had my first of 15 children. And I look back on 2011, 9, 8, 10, 7, 6 as a missed opportunity for just going to places. Especially movies. Like, what was I doing with my life? Every single night that I spent at home that I wasn't eating at a restaurant, sitting there in the restaurant and eating and going to a movie, especially now that you think about it in the quarantine, like I had all, I could have gone to anything. I could have done anything I wanted to. And there were so many nights, there were so many, I didn't go to see Moneyball. I didn't go to see Bridesmaids. What the fuck was I doing?
Probably a lot of watching baseball and worried about your fantasy team.
I just like sat and watched on David Sykes's, what is the MLB thing called? Extra innings or something?
Sounds right.
I remember just sitting and watching some Gio Gonzalez starts.
That's the saddest thing I've ever heard.
God, just, this is some advice for people out there. Don't pay attention to fantasy baseball when you're able to safely. Go out into the world and do things before you have children, because it gets terrible after that.
Wow. Especially when you get to number 15.
Just a little bit of advice, because 2011 was my last year without a child.
It's true. On that note.
I also should say that I think The Walking Dead. Did we talk about The Walking Dead last week?
Yeah, The Walking Dead had already premiered.
Okay, well, it was 2011. It was when I was staying at your house.
That's when you started watching
it. Yeah, that me and Mrs. Fantasy Genius watched it on, like, Halloween weekend. And it was a pretty cool time to watch a show.
Right.
Now I'm just depressed about how I could have done stuff with my life back in 2011.
Couldn't we all? All right, thanks for listening.
Thanks. Okay, Bumbershoot, 2011. So I think this was the year that, if I remember correctly, oh, yeah. See, this is a good one we had to talk about. I think I was saying to you that they mistakenly let me be part of a committee that booked Bumbershoot.
That is correct.
And is this the right year that I'm looking at? 6-1-2011. Oh, okay, last year's Axe. Okay, they were, so I think this might have been the first year that I was a part of it. Maybe this was the second year. I remember Jan going to go see Hall & Oates, and I think Fitz and the Tantrums opened for Hall & Oates, which we eventually saw Fitz and the Tantrums play outside before the weekend. Is that right? Did that happen?
It's possible that happened.
I don't know how those consecutive artists played, but I'm pretty sure we went to a Bumbershoot where Fitz and the Tantrums played right before the weekend, a few years later.
The weekend was more memorable. I remember that.
The weekend, not the weekend.
Yes.
So this was
the weekend, no E.
The Bumbershoot that I mentioned, Wiz Khalifa. Like, Wiz Khalifa was one of the biggest hip-hop artists in the world in 2011. It was like
Black and Yellow.
Black and Yellow.
Taking the World by Storm.
Always hated that song.
Well, I mean, obviously.
Yeah, I'm not getting fucking Pittsburgh Steelers song. We still weren't over it. We hadn't won a Super Bowl at the time.
Correct.
But Wiz Khalifa was headlining. Main stage was in Key Arena. This, I think, was the first year that the main stage was in Key Arena for Bumbershoot. Wiz Khalifa was headlining, and playing before him, ready for his star-making performance, was Macklemore, and this was when he brought out Sean Kemp awkwardly to stand there. But it was like, I remember Macklemore.
Oscars was open, he's on stage.
Oh,
what a year for Sean Kemp.
Great moment for Sean Kemp in 2011. But this was like, oh, Macklemore is going to be like a massive star into that. Like, this was right before it happened. But it was clear, like, that there were more people at that show. A lot of people were excited about Wiz Khalifa. There were as many people at that show excited for Macklemore as there were for Wiz Khalifa. And he went on to sell out. I mean, I think a Macklemore jersey hangs in the rafters of Key Arena, if I recall correctly.
Well, nothing hangs in the rafters
still
anymore.
To this day under construction.
Yeah, no.
They were like, the roof has to remain, and the Macklemore jersey has to stay up there.
Bad news, the Macklemore banner was taken down well before.
They were like, the Macklemore banner, it's just... Do what you will with the space.
And the time capsule that we put up there during the 96 NBA Finals.
What happened to that? About. Wait, did you ever actually get an answer to that?
No, I might need to try it, see if Randy can help with that.
Why would Randy be able to help with that?
He might have some connections.
Okay. I mean, I'm not questioning. I'm just asking why. If Randy is listening, I'm not saying that Randy wouldn't know how to do it. I'm just asking why you would say that. But Randy knows people.
He does.
But yeah, that performance at Bumbershoot was the first time that I'm sure that Macklemore played Key Arena, and the first of many times after that, really.
Yep.
So that was extremely memorable. And if this was a year that I was on the Bumber board, I take full credit for it.
There you go.
Yeah, Macklemore would have been nothing without me. Same with Hall & Oates, too. Throw them in there. I went to go see Hall & Oates, and Jan went early to go watch Fits of the Tantrums and was raving about it.
Of course. Before Baby Fantasy Genius became a big Fits in the Tantrum fan.
I wonder if he remembers anything about them. Probably not.
Very doubtful.
Man, this is like a who's who of local artists from Seattle in 2011. It really is like just tons. Like, it's pretty incredible. Starfucker, Shabazz Palaces, Champagne.
What chance was it? Bumbershoot in 2015?
2015?
Yeah. That was the year the Weeknd was there.
I don't think I went.
Canceled.
I saw Chance at Sasquatch earlier on.
I mean, you went to the Weeknd. We were just talking about it.
He played that same day?
He must have canceled, because I don't remember this. But he was on the bill for Saturday. Originally.
There you go. All right.
There you go.